This is Dick Foster, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 7th of June 2012. Dick Foster, Part 2.
You built not just one hut, Dick, on Danko Island, or whatever it was called. You built two huts.
I'm sorry, that's not correct. I didn't build the second one. The second one was built on the outgoing, I'm not sure which ship it would have been, but by Pitch Palmer and Brian Bailey, who were on their way out. Les Harris would have been there as well, because they, three of them only did a one-year stint in the days when people did only 1 year. And the hut was, which was manufactured in Port Stanley, was built by them. Earlier in the year, the reconnaissance party had established that there was a way up to the plateau from Cape Recluse. Not an easy one, a very steep one, but nevertheless a way. And I'm not sure to the political background to this, to be absolutely honest, don't like that phrase, but somewhere along the line, there had been the decision made that a party, sledging party, should come down from Hope Bay, and this would be the first party to cross the Grahamland Peninsula. It all seemed to me to be a bit of a contrived thing, but a great journey nevertheless, and that whilst we hoped that we were going to do surveying, because Dennis Kershaw, there was now Dennis, I was Dennis Kershaw, the base personnel had changed, mm-hmm. and Dennis Kershaw was now there from Anvers Island, and a new FID, Ray McGowan, whom you've met, I think, had joined us. So I split the base into two. And so three of us, a route having been established, a hut having been built, three of us went with the object of doing, of surveying up there. We'd been up in the summertime with the boat doing surveying, doing some surveying and some geological search in the harbour.
This is a map of Grahamland.
Yes, this is the main game. That's Anvers Island. Now that's Brabant. Oh, wait, that's Brabant Island. Anvers is next. So Brabant Island wasn't here. Well, that's the one we were supposed to go.
Where was your?
But we were. It did eventually end up. So that I can identify it. Anvers Bay.
Rongi Island is there.
There's Brabant. There's the base there.
Yeah. So it's just the east of Rongi Island.
Yes. And Cape Recluse is there. And that's the route.
So up. Cape Recluse is another peninsula further to the east of the of Rongi Island.
Yes, east and north from the original base.
Portal Point. Yeah.
Well, it's now called Portal Point. It certainly was never called. I've had a little bit of a conversation via email, but we never knew that it was called Portal Point. It was always
Cape Recluse.
Cape Recluse.
by Charlotte Bay.
Yeah.
So the Hope Bay Party were going to come over the top of it.
The Hope Bay Party came down the Detroit Plateau, the Herbert Plateau, across the waste to the Foster Plateau.
Mm-hmm.
It's all very nice, you see, when you know the bloke who gives the names to the...
Oh, that's your personal plateau.
Oh, that's mine, yes.
Okay. Yeah. And then they're going to turn north.
And that was where we met them. Or rather, where we left the indication for them as to where they should go. And then this was the way down to Cape Recluse.
By turning north down the glacier.
Yeah. And there... Sorry?
The Bailey Glacier, is that?
Yes, that would be Brian Bailey, as I say. Yeah. It's, and I think the Kershaw... the Ketty Rock, somewhere over there, and...
So the plan was for them to come, and you were going to go and meet them, weren't you?
Yeah. And we were not actually to meet them. We were to meet them in a sense, but I don't think anyone would find that route down.
Without guidance.
Without knowing it was there.
Yeah. So did it all go according to plan?
No, not exactly. It took them a considerable degree longer than they thought it was going to do. We were up on the top waiting for them. We spent a long time in the field trying to do survey work, and we were thwarted by what I've, the atmospheric conditions that I've described before. But that particular exercise went well, although we had to go down onto half rations. We waited for them. And we were in contact, not with them, but with other bases, with this 68 set. And they... So we knew, more or less, how long it was going to take for them to arrive, because they would be talking back to... Hope Bay, and Hope Bay will be talking to bases that we could contact on this little 68 set.
Yeah.
But they were gradually delayed by bad weather. I mean, we had appalling weather, but for the most part, they were up above it. So we went on to half rations, but we knew that they were getting closer and closer. And that they were going to make it okay. So we retreated down to one of our higher depots so that we could get enough grub to keep going on there. Went back up again, and I'd left the message up on the top, one of the... snow cone, I suppose you could call it. And then all of a sudden we heard noises. We were in the tents. We heard noises and we heard dogs. And they were with us, which was nice.
This is Wally Herbert.
Yes.
Dennis Kershaw?
No, Dennis Kershaw with me.
He was with you.
Yes, Dennis and Ray.
McGowan, yes.
We were the team. The three-man team.
And they brought... Four men.
They had four men.
What did that prove then? That exercise. What was the?
I don't really know. Wally did a sledge traverse all the way along, and that map there, you will see it attributes at least some of the work to him. Mm. I don't think that was the object of the exercise. There were, by that stage, I suppose most of long journeys had been done, and the germ of an idea must have been born in somebody's mind, and I don't know for life from who it was, but obviously Sacfidge would have to approve it, that somehow coming from down here with Hope Bay over there would be crossing the first traverse of the Antarctic Peninsula.
So it was to help the political claim.
It would certainly be part of it.
Support the political claim, yes, yeah.
Certainly, but doing some very valuable survey work on the way.
But your own trip up from the recluse hut onto the plateau must have been pretty strenuous.
It was. I mean, it's 5,000 feet above sea level, and we started at sea level. And you're carting everything with you. It's a relatively short way. It's amazing looking at it. I think that we spent 100 days actually out in the field during that 9 months or so. But it was just a desperate slog all the time. We lost one depot totally. It doesn't snow much in the Antarctic, I understand, but it does blow about a lot. And we lost one, and we put a pole on the top and guy wires down, but we lost it totally. So that didn't help. But I mean, much of the time we got 40-pound sledge ration boxes on our backs going uphill on ski. Wooden ski, and they had skins, so-called skins, on the skis. I'm going to draw a sketch now.
No, use words.
Right. Yes, of course. Well, what happened was that after a very short time, with these skins under the skins were a material. No, they weren't actual skins. They were a material with which had a nap on them, which meant that they acted as friction against the snow. But all they had were fitted over the toe of the ski, and then straps across the ski, two or three places, and then an end strap. So after continuous use, which of course is what we were doing, you would end up with a ski, which is straight. You would end up with the skins having captured between themselves and the ski great lumps of snow. So the underside of the skin was bulging in little bulges all the way along the ski. So you didn't have a flat surface. It was like a series of great lumps under the skis, which were held there by the skins. So you were carrying an enormous weight of really what amounted to ice, because it was so compressed, of ice under the ski every time you lifted your foot up. And we had a lot of soft snow, and when we didn't have soft snow, if we had soft snow, there was no way in which you could pull the sledges, because they would they were like bulldozers. So then we would offload the sledge and just plod on, backpacking. I think a ration box weighed 40 pounds. But it was all good competitive stuff. Dennis was much the same sort of person as myself. And we would break into a run when we were coming to the crest, see who got there first, you know. And then we would carry up the sledge. So you've got this 12-foot sledge across your back with the tents as well. If it has blown, as it very often did, then the surface could be so hard that you could hardly put the pick end of an ice axe into it. So going up steep slopes like that, well, we were skidding, or we could use the sledge, but you couldn't get traction. So, yes, in a word, it was a slog. It was a good job we were fit.
You started off with two tents, I think, on this particular expedition, but then reduced to one.
That's right, yes. We had pyramid tent, which was a standard travelling tent, and a mountain tent. I can't quite think why we were so cruel, because it was usually Ray that was in the mountain tent. Oh, I mean, we would all be together in the main tent for eating our pemmican or our porridge in the mornings. But then he would retire to the mountain tent, which we had the two tunnels face to face. He would retire to, and I certainly on one morning. The poor chap just couldn't move at all. The guys had pulled out. There only was a small tent, one-man tent. The guys had pulled out. Snow. He was like that.
He's pinioned, was he? Pinioned under the snow.
He was pinioned under the snow, totally. So we said, that's not fair. That's not right. So we dug a hole and abandoned the mountain tent. And we slept three in a two-man tent.
The mountain tent was rectangular?
No. Standard tent shape. It was a ridgepole tent. If you picture a tent,
yeah,
so that was what it was like.
Vertical ends.
No. Our vertical ends, yes. Yeah. And a triangular shape.
And this proved once and for all that Scott's plan of pyramid tents was the right decision.
Oh, you certainly had the right tents, yes. Yeah, because ours were, I suppose they're still much the same. I don't know, mind, I must confess. But pictures I have seen are more or less the same.
So Ray was having to shout for help, was he, from time to time?
Yeah. I think he shouted for help that morning. I think we sort of got up and were sort of, from this tent.
And there was a problem with carbon monoxide on one particular occasion as well, I believe.
Oh, heavens, yes. Yes, there was.
Because
that could have been nasty. What happened? The tents. Well, you probably know all this before because you've the tents have a little ventilator. The tents in those days, anyway, had a little ventilator. It was a little bit of rubber tubing, really, of about an inch diameter, in the top of the tent. And, of course, all the cooking is done on primer stoves, on a primer stove, which, of course, gives off noxious fumes, which is great, perfectly well, okay, because the tent acts as a kind of funnel. The hot air goes up. It can be very hot in the top of a tent and outside. But on this occasion, what had happened was the wind had changed direction and the ventilator had become clogged with snow. I don't know who realised it first, but we suddenly realised that something nasty was happening, and we had headaches, and opened the tunnel to the tent. And luckily we didn't suffer from any ill effects. But... was it Ray who said that, I wonder? I
can't. Oh, it's in your notes.
I'd almost forgotten it.
Yeah.
So it's in my notes.
It's in the notes you wrote. So,
oh, right.
Yeah. So when there was when you heard the Hope Bay party, was that a film moment, a joyous reunion, Hollywood moment?
Well, it wasn't a film moment for me. I don't think it was a film moment for any. There are some photographs, but... No, I mean, not everybody out there with... I mean, I didn't have a camera, I don't think. But, yeah, I mean, it was a great moment, more particularly for them, of course, than for us in a way, because we've been sort of sitting there, you know. They've been the ones who've been doing the hard physical work. I suppose in a way we were doing the hard mental work in hoping that they were going to get there.
So when you, the 70 of you then went down to Recluse...
That's right.
...hut.
Yes.
Which, of course, is only big enough for three people.
Yes, yes.
Is that?
Yeah, three, yes.
So how do you solve that problem?
Oh, that was simple, because they camped outside and we had all the meals inside. It was a good thing, really, because somewhere in my notes originally, I say that when we were in the huts, the hut was about as basic as anything could be. And all our cooking was done on Primus stoves. Somehow or other, another sort of stove got into the hut when they finally took it down and took it over to Port Stanley. But we only had Primus stoves. And it was my bright idea to make an oven out of a 5-pound flour tin. It was either flour tin or dehydrated vegetable tin.
Was it one tin or two?
I can't remember. It was one or two.
Do you not fasten two tins together?
Yeah, I think we must have put two. They would have been too small with just one. And then we wrapped it in asbestos cloth. I suppose more to protect our fingers than anything else. And sat it on three Primus stoves. And the solder on the inner one melted. And we only had three Primus stoves. It was the solder, it wasn't a replaceable part that melted, it was the stem into the body of the thing that melted. So we now only had two. And they had to do us for all the cooking in the base and all the camping, all the time we were in the field. So we didn't make any more bread until the boys came down and we got down to the bottom. And then we got scads of Primus stoves. They got theirs and we got ours. So we reinstated the oven. And I baked a cake for Lee Rice's birthday. There's a picture of it. There's a picture in the archive there somewhere, which I sent. He was a sailor, so it had a little boat on it, and we were able to bake a cake by cutting the burnt bottom off and then turning it over and cutting another burnt bottom off, which had been the top, and making a very very respectable and edible cake.
Before the Hope Bay chaps arrived, you had actually really only expected to be at the Recluse Hut for a short period of time.
No, we were always going to be there for the whole winter.
You were?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes, because bear in mind that this was the access to the Grahamland Plateau, yeah. The only one as far as we knew. We'd failed down at the bottom there, where we couldn't get up onto the plateau. And, of course, the intention always was to carry out survey work. I mean, we carted the theodolite and the staffs and everything with us all the time. And we would, at the slightest excuse, try to do something. But then the weather would come down. And no, that, I mean, there are some very despairing comments in my sledging notebooks, really.
Were you getting depressed?
Nope.
At Recluse?
No. No, not the slightest. We never had any arguments at all. I really don't know why, but we didn't. Any more than we had amongst the six of us. Because if there had been arguments amongst three, that would have been death. Mm. Death. Ray told us all about what it was like in Northern Ireland, insofar as we could understand him. but having said that, we could understand him then. I think Ray's accent has tended to get a little bit thicker as he's got older. So he told us all about Northern Ireland, and I'd only recently, of course, come back from the Far East, and Dennis was funny. He was a funny Lancashireman, a funny Lancastrian, and he played a lot of cricket, and I remember one time when he was bowling against some thick set Lancastrian there who was in knee cricket, and the Lancastrian said to him something like, "If thou does that again, I'll thump thee into bloody ground like a tent peg." I think he bowled him a bouncer or something, you know. That was my approximation of Dennis, bless his souls.
What sort of chap was he?
Oh, he was great. He was great. We got on like a house on fire, although we didn't carry on much afterwards. Ways diverged. I don't know. I mean, he was damned hard working. He was very fit. He would do more than his share, given the opportunity. As indeed would Ray. As indeed, I hope, would I. You know, funny. A good egg.
And Wally Herbert, of course, you also got to know quite well.
Yes.
Tell me about Wally.
Yeah, well, Wally was his first experience of polo work. But it had always been something. He was a driven man. Mm. It was great. He, Dennis and I, at that time, seemed somehow to strike up a particular friendship, which persisted between Dennis and Wally all the time, really. Whereas I went abroad here, there, and I, unfortunately, not a good correspondent. So I drifted out, and it wasn't until I knew that Dennis had died, because I rejoined the club, the Bass Club, yes. And I heard that Dennis had died. I got in touch with his widow, Mary, whom I knew, of course, and again got in touch with Wally. As I say, I mean, he was a driven man. I only wish my wife was very angry with me because I didn't keep in touch with him. We went to see him once in Lichfield when he was preparing the Transarctic expedition, and we had a very good chat there, and it was before we were married, actually, and we came away, and Euron said, "Have you ever seen a man who is so meticulous?" I said, "I've never seen a study like that," and it was true, you know. It was necessary, but he was a very good friend. But no, it's not but. And a very driven man, because he knew, it wasn't like the rest of us. He wasn't down there really for the one-off exercise. He was down there as the start of a career as a polar explorer, which he went on to achieve with very great success, of course.
What was his personality like? Was he phlegmatic or the opposite?
No, he was lively. I wouldn't have said that he was phlegmatic at all, no. He was bright. I don't mean bright in the sense of intelligent. but bright in the sense of being aware, of being there. And I mean, obviously, he was a leader. But again, I suspect a leader in the way that I would like to be a leader, a motivator, of people, rather than a commander of people. He was very forthright, obviously. The occasion when he was on the ice there and he called the people in the Royal Geographical Society unfortunate names, which certain, I think it was Ranulph Fiennes, thought was the reason why he didn't get a knighthood before he got it, in spite of Prince Charles saying something about he should be distilled, his spirit should be distilled, and I've forgotten the detail, but no, he was, I was proud, very proud that he was a friend.
So there we are with the seven of you now at Recluse Hut, plus a fair number of dogs to feed as well, I presume.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of shooting a seal, was it?
Yeah, well, there were two things about shooting the seal. One was that we, obviously we come to the end of the sledging exercise, so what we did was to, the Hope Bay boys were used to killing seal because they had to kill them for dog food. We weren't so used. So they had a 38 or a 45 revolver. And we lashed two sledges together with some empty oil drums and went seal hunting on this raft approaching a floe. And, I mean, the seals weren't... It was like, what's the phrase, shooting pigs in a barrel, you know. They would just look at you. With great big eyes. It was rather horrible to kill them, you know. But dog food. So that was a very successful exercise. Very
well, there's one
that
moment which wasn't terribly successful.
Oh, no, that's right. that was the time when we came across a leopard seal on the seashore. And a live leopard seal on the seashore. It was on a bit of ice shelf. And they're big beasts, you know. The head of a leopard seal is about as big as this, and the teeth are about as big as my thumb. So luckily, as I say, we had this 38 or 45. So one of the Hope Bay boys, I've forgotten who it was now, can't remember the names actually, apart from Lee, put several bullets into the... And, I mean, these are big things, 9mm sort of thing. And we were absolutely certain it was dead, we thought, and we approached it. And all of a sudden, it probably was dead, but it convulsed like that. Head went up, tail went up, and we flew to the four winds. You've never seen seven people move as quickly as we could. Away from this dangerous beast. I think it was dead. Anyway, it died. We probably put a few more shells into it. And then it made a very good supper for the dogs for several days. Because we had to wait quite a long time to be picked up. Because the Shackleton hit a berg. And I'm not sure where... We weren't in touch, of course, with it. We only learnt through other means. Probably went to South Georgia to be repaired there.
It did. The dry dock.
In dry dock of South Georgia.
Fishing with a few inches to spare.
Yeah. Oh, right. Well, that's something I never knew. And then eventually it came. And
it was about 6 weeks later, wasn't it? At least
I'd remembered four, but yes. It was of that order.
It was late, anyway.
Yes, yeah.
Did they take you and Wally and his Hope Bay team out?
Oh, they took us all out. Yeah,
because of course Danko was to be abandoned, wasn't it?
Well, no, Danko was used for a further year.
One more year, of course, yes. Yeah. But Duncan Boston was in charge.
That's right. Yeah.
When you heard that it had been abandoned, were you disappointed or was it no surprise?
Well, it was no surprise because it was the wrong base in the wrong place. I don't think that's not quite right. It was no place for a base. even though the second year, before we left, we got... Oh no, was that the last year? But we got a 14-port fiberglass boat, which made life an awful lot easier and made me quite unpopular back in base because I was rather rude about the boats that they sent us previously. And when I got a message, everything came in code, you know, in those days. When I got a message saying we're doing the best we can, I just sent back something, you're not doing well, good enough. Which is why they probably offered me the job of stores and equipment officer.
Well, how did that happen? Because you were leaving the Antarctic, presumably for the last time, you thought, on the Shackleton.
Yes.
But you didn't leave Bast's.
No, I was offered the travel. I was before we left. I was offered the job of stores and equipment officer.
Okay, in London.
Well, it would be partly 6 months in London, 6 months on the travelling around the bases.
Right.
And I accepted it. It was before we left because I had to be back by about May, and. I travelled back through South America. I think we were about the first there were Dennis and Pete Wild and myself and Juno. I forgot the name of the bloke who came with me. I don't know why. I didn't really know him. And unfortunately, he died very soon after we arrived back in England in a motor accident. So I didn't really get a chance to know him properly. Except during the journey. And Wally came up by himself. So there were two groups of us came back. And I knew I had to be back by May. So unfortunately, I had to leave when we got to Colombia and catch a ship from there to get back. During that period... I never really got my head properly around the job. I didn't allow myself the time to do it because personal matters intervened. A Norwegian manufacturer came to see me. I didn't know that he was a man. He was the boss man when he came humping this great big thing full of gear up the stairs. And I was going to go to Norway that year, climbing in the Jotunheim. And he invited me to stay at his house, which was a collection of restored huts from all the different provinces in Norway. Vernacular housing. Beautiful.
So this was in Norway?
This was in Norway, above Oslo Fjord.
Okay.
Anyway. So I accepted, of course. He got me a cheap air ticket as well. it was the head of the Norwegian Tourist Board as well. Anyway, I went down to see him in his office and he said, what are you going to do tonight? And I said, well, I'll probably go and have a look around Oslo. And he said, well, I'm sure Miss Pouse will show you around. This tall, slim girl walking towards the door, his secretary, sort of went, who, me? And that was the girl that I eventually married.
This is Jurin.
This is Jurin. Having met her and fallen in love and decided that I was going to marry her, it didn't seem appropriate that I would continue with the job, which meant I was going to be in this country 6 months and elsewhere in 6 months. So... I resigned, in a word.
But you did do one...
I did one further trip down.
Which actually, yes. Again, the Shackleton nearly ruined your plans.
Well, yes, yeah, we went, I think it was Stonington, you know, I'm not entirely sure. And I say, I didn't really grip this job. I mean, the germ of what I should be doing as a stores and equipment officer was forming at that time. I mean, for example, the first thing that I'd occurred to me already is we shouldn't have beige tents against a white background.
Yes.
Yeah? You could find a far better chance of finding them if they were fluorescent orange, you know. So I started to think, but on this occasion, the trip down was before I'd really got my mind around these things properly. And yes, we were stuck in the ice. And first of all, I think she was, I'm pretty certain she was a US Coast Guard icebreaker. Mm-hmm. The Edisto came down and she got stuck in the ice. And the North Wind, the USN, I suppose, will be North Wind icebreaker, came halfway around the world. We were stuck there quite a long time. Mm. Halfway around the world, and broke both of us out. So we had, going out, we had the North Wind, and these icebreakers, you know, can turn on the sixpence. North Wind, the Edisto, and the poor old shack in the back, I don't know how many screws she got, probably two, but she couldn't turn the sixpence. And along, on one occasion, I was on the bridge, and the Edisto in front of us, and she had helicopter platform on the back with stays out, with netting, obviously safety netting, the crew. We couldn't stop. She stopped. I don't know whether she put her screws in reverse or what. Anyway, she didn't stop, and we went along. And all these Navy men were sort of throwing some of themselves out of the way, and we chopped all these projecting supports to the netting on the helicopter platform before we ground to a halt between the ship and the surrounding ice. Yes.
There's a note here which suggests that Eleanor Honeywell was with you on that trip. Is that the case or not?
No, Eleanor Honeywell was the was a girl in the office in London,
right?
With whom I shared an office,
right?
There was no one else. So, she, in a sense, she was the London presence. Mm-hmm. Continuous presence of the of FIDS at that time, before she married Sir Vivian Fuchs.
Oh, did she?
I think so. I'm almost certain so.
I'm sure you're right. I just never thought of that before.
I've said that. Mm.
Well, I'll check.
Yes,
worry.
Yes, you can. Please do, please do. Okay. It's an idea I had.
All right. Were there any funny moments that you had down there? I'm thinking particularly of something to do with a chair, a broken chair.
Yes. The first year, and the bergs used to drift up and down the Le Maire Channel, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some very big ones. I've not mentioned this, as far as I can remember, ever before, but on one occasion, I was out, and I think it was with Pidge, and there was this great tabular berg. But it had been in the water quite a time, and it had tunnels, in a word, right through it. And I said to Pidge, shall we go through there?
In what? In a dinghy?
In a dinghy.
Yeah.
Yeah. with an outboard on it. And he says, yeah, yeah, why not? So we went in. I mean, it was a great echoing vault of ice up above us. And there was the noise of the engine was sort of echoing from the sides. And I think I said, I think we'd better turn the engine off. So we turned the engine off and gently rowed very quietly out through this tunnel in the boat. But the one that you were perhaps reminding me of was a much smaller one that grounded outside the base, right outside the base, about 20 feet tall. And we had a broken... It was Sunday, as I recall. We were all being idle, I suspect. And we were looking out from the kitchen, through the kitchen window. And someone, I don't know who it was, probably me, suggested, wouldn't it be funny if we took this broken chair, which we tried to mend but couldn't, and perched it on the top of this berg, because it was in the form of a spire. A spire, if you can imagine it, which broadened out of the base, and then in front of it was a kind of basin full of seawater with an outlet on one side through which the water flowed, swished backwards and forwards. So wearing sea boots, a couple of us went out, and I can't remember who was the other idiot, and wearing sea boots, and I climbed up. I'm not quite sure how I managed to climb up it, because it was quite steep. Anyway, climbed up, put this chair on this pinnacle of ice, lost my grip, slid down, went round this basin full of water and out into the sea in my sea boots. But I kicked the sea boots off, so we lost a pair of sea boots. And, of course, the boat was there with the other fella in it, and he pulled me on board. There was another unfortunate thing. It felt very unfortunate at the time when on the base that same year, and we did have a Lee Enfield 303 on base, of absolutely no use for anything whatsoever, because we weren't going to kill a seal just to eat seal liver or seal meat or whatever, and nobody liked the idea of killing penguins. Although there were penguins in abundance. We did try once, but it was like trying to kill a rubber ball. So we gave up after a while and walked away. But I had this 303, and we were just standing outside the hut. It was a pleasant, cool evening, and there were the, snowy petrels. But it was snowy petrels, probably. Out the sea, and I drew a bead on one that was hovering like that and fired at it. It was about a good 100 yards away. And I hit it. Lord alone knows how that could conceivably have happened. I was not a good shot with a rifle in the army, so it was pure coincidence, and this little bird dropped like a stone. Well, this mass of feathers, because it had been hit by a 303 bullet, dropped. And I never felt so sad and at the same time angry with myself, you know. There was no way that I could possibly have hit it. And yet I did. Rather horrible. I can still remember.
On this final summer down south, when you were going around the bases... Yes. Stores, logistics, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Was there anything of any significance that happened on that trip?
Well, other than being iced in.
Yeah. On the actual bases themselves. I mean, you saw bases you hadn't seen before.
Well, I did, but honestly, no. There was nothing really that I can recall. As I say, I was...
By that time, your mind was elsewhere, was it?
Oh, well, not really. It wasn't. It wasn't. It was just that, as I said, in other words, I was feeling my way, and I was still dedicated. Although, but I hadn't decided, I don't think I'd really decided what the job description was. Would have come next year, I think.
But then you met Euron and that was in that, and life changed. Did you have any regrets about departing from Bass?
Oh, yes, lots. Yeah, I mean, it was a great time. But I was not the kind of person, and there have been in the history of Bass quite a few, who winter after winter. Mm. I obviously wasn't that kind of person. I think I would have made a good Stormfront equipment officer had things not actually ended up as they did, because I was intensely interested. Mm. And it was just at the time when, we started to get aircraft. Mm. And things were changing. I think it was the cusp of a change then. To the new, the FIDS as it now exists, you know.
So what did he do instead, very briefly?
I trained as a quantity surveyor, but I decided I didn't particularly want to be a quantity surveyor, and I still wanted to go abroad, so I converted myself into an engineer, that's to say a construction engineer, with much the same knowledge, of course. And I, first of all, I joined a big company called Costain, and I went to the Persian Gulf, and I was the engineer when we built an air terminal building for what was then the airport for Dubai. I smile because I've been to Dubai since, and I mean, the change is indescribable. And built a NATO aerodrome runway. Came back from that, married Euron. And we went then, pair of us, to Libya, to Tripoli, to some construction projects in Tripoli and Benghazi. Came back from that, spent 2 years and a bit in the UK. I'd taught myself Spanish while I was, I've got a book down on the basis because of the journey through South America. I was asked if I'd like to go to, I could either be promoted to something which is, was called a sort of area director, or I could go to, in this company, or I could go to Spain. I went home and said to Euron, what should we do? And she said, we'll go to Spain. So we went to Spain. We were a year down in Jerez de la Frontera in Andalucía, and then 3 years in Madrid. And then we came back, and that was in, came back in 71. And very briefly spent some time up in Northumberland with a company where the chief executive had known me and invited me to join them, which was a total disaster. I joined John Lane Construction here in Yorkshire. And really, that was the end of the travels, because in the first 10 years of our married life, we'd moved house in 3 different countries and in 10 different places. And we ended up here in 1971 and we're still here.
So how does the Antarctic, as you're a well-travelled man as you are, How do those 2 years in the Antarctic rate in the Dick Foster life story?
Yes. Well, I mean, there is this strange thing, which I suppose everyone comes to, that as you get older, things that happened earlier on in your career seem somehow to become more important. And, oh, let me just say very briefly, I would not have missed it for the world. It was very character forming. I really think it is, because I did all sorts of things in construction, which I shouldn't have done, because there was some area manager or something who said, "You did what?" And I would say, "Well, yeah, I mean, it needed to be, you weren't on your own. You did the things that had to be done, the things that you thought had to be done, the things that needed to be done, and you weren't fazed by anything." And I'm sure that would apply to anyone who's been down there. It's character forming. As well as totally, completely and absolutely enjoyable.
Marvellous. Well, shall we leave it there, Dick?
Shall we?
Excellent. Thank you very much
indeed. Yes. No, thank you.